Hello and welcome to the Game Theory Podcast. I'm your host, Sam Vecini, represented by The Athletic. Today on the show, we've got a really fun one planned. The Phoenix Suns are in the NBA Finals. I don't know that I can remember a more surprising NBA Finals participant over the course of the last at least 15 years of the NBA, maybe. So I got in someone who's been rooting for the Suns for quite a while now, who is, I think, just the absolute funniest fucking human being on the NBA internet. It's Sreeker Jasthi. You guys know him as Sreeky Shooter over on Twitter. Sreeker, how you doing, man?
I'm doing great, Sam. Thank you for having me and for that very flattering intro. But I'm doing well. Suns are in the finals, like you just said. And can't say I've had a better time rooting for this Phoenix Suns over the last 15 years.
So I just kind of want to go into like you to start, so people understand a little bit more about what exactly it is that you do on the internet. You just consistently make jokes. You are the person that, like, I guess, like, my first question would be, how weird is it when you see something like, you know, going to Hooters with the fellas, going to the finals with the fellas, take off in the way that it did? Because I feel like you are the person that, like, found those Devin Booker tweets from when he was like a teenager and started to popularize them.
Yeah, I mean, it's great. I'm not gonna lie. It's wonderful that that was caught on, because I thought, for me, I personally just found those amusing. I happened to sort of, you know, find at least a few. There was more than a few. I think he had about 20 to 30 tweets, Devin Booker did, back when he was 15 or 16 years old, about Hooters, Applebee's, Buffalo Wild Wings. You know, you name an American chain restaurant, Devin Booker has tweeted about going there with the fellas, with pops, with some group or individual. And I just found it really amusing. And I think it was during the bubble last year when, coincidentally, when the Suns really started to sort of come together for the first time in a long time, that Suns Twitter sort of came together to rally around those going to Hooters with the fellas tweets. And that kind of became sort of the motto, at least for me, throughout most of this season as well, and caught on with a bunch of Suns fans who kind of took it and ran with it. Yeah, I mean, it's amusing, it's funny, the players seem to like it, Devin Booker has alluded to it a couple times himself, the team tweets memes about it, so it's all in good fun.
It's like the lowest stakes fun humanly possible, you know what I mean? Like, I feel like that's kind of the key to a good internet thing. Like, yeah, you can do the weird, like, or like the crazy high end, like, meme that, you know, makes fun of people, and oftentimes that works because people like dunking on other people. Like, today the internet's main character is Rachel Nichols, right? But yep. Also, the things that I tend to get the most amusement and enjoyment out of are the stupid things. Even in, like, movies, yep. Like, I don't know if you saw Barb and Star go to Vista Del Mar. Like, there are just so many little stupid things in that movie that make me laugh, despite it being this ridiculous high concept, like, almost sci-fi, like, comedy movie. What, I guess, like, when you're looking at creating, or not even creating, just like making jokes on the internet, like, what are you looking for? Because consistently you are someone that goes viral for making just the dumbest, funniest jokes on the internet.
Yeah, I mean, you kind of hit on a big key part of it, which is dumb, right? I mean, like, it's stupid things. It's like, I think it's finding amusement in the stupidity of life. I mean, sports, yeah. Sports are great. Don't get me wrong. Sports are wonderful. I'm a huge, huge NBA fan, and a huge Suns fan. And I think the thing that I enjoy about NBA Twitter, or at least how I approach NBA Twitter, especially over the years, how I've approached it, is it's sports are meant to be fun. And if you're not having fun watching them, talking about them, engaging with them, then you're doing it wrong. And my way of having fun is to obviously watch them, discuss them, soak in, you know, analysis from people who are actually good at analyzing the sport, like you. But my role in it is to make jokes. I just enjoy the silliness of things. And if we go back to the example, why I find, let's, I'm thinking Hooters tonight with the fellas, a funny sort of meme to keep calling back to is, it's just, in my mind, it's 15-year-old Devin Booker going to Hooters with the fellas. And that has become sort of, as I was saying, the motto for this Suns team this year in my eyes, because really, it's poetic in a way. Hooters is anything you want it to be. The fellas is whoever you want it to be. And everyone should be always trying to go to Hooters with their fellas. And I just, you know, I admire it. And I think it's the stupidity of a silly little tweet like that blowing up and me sort of driving attention to it over and over again, because I just find it amusing. And I think there's other things across other teams, other players. Sometimes I do, I will say, I do get a little carried away with the slanderous tweets. I will be the first to admit that, but I try to sort of fall back on, you know, at the end of the day, I like watching the sport. I like watching all the players that I tweet jokes about. And as a Suns fan, if whoever the Suns are playing, I might have to tweet some slander every now and then. So sorry in advance to the Bucks and to Giannis for the next 2 weeks, but the game's the game.
Yeah, like, it's funny, like, I saw that you tweeted shitposting works, like, after the Suns tweeted, we're thinking NBA Finals with the fellas, like, it just does, like, it's funny, and I think that you kind of hit the nail on the head there, where it's like, you want to find the right combination of dumb, low stakes, but also easily identifiable, right? Like you said, like, Hooters can be anywhere, you know, the fellas can be just your boys or your friends or your girlfriends, like whatever it is. And it kind of works. And yeah, like you obviously, like you made a lot of jokes about Patrick Beverley this week, which was fantastic because like Patrick Beverley talking about like Steph Curry had the last 5 years, the next 5 years are mine. Like what the fuck is Patrick Beverley?
Hilarious. That just ages better every season.
It really does. I mean, again, though, that's like a dumb, like, absurdity of the situation thing, and it's just so enjoyable to go down the road of. Do you have a favorite, like, funniest thing that you can remember doing that, like, made you personally laugh the hardest?
Ooh, good question. I mean, recency bias aside with the whole digging up Devin Booker's old tweets things. I would say, yeah, I think the stupidest thing that I think I was the most surprised by, to be honest, because there's been surprising things that have happened from random tweets that I put out there is the the fake Instagram comment from LeBron a couple of years ago.
Oh God, yeah, I remember that about Anthony Davis.
Yeah, and this was before AD got traded, when all the rumors were flying about how the Lakers wanted him, LeBron wanted him, it was clutch, etc. AD was put in the trade request, and it was, so first of all, I had created a fake Venmo payment from LeBron to Anthony Davis of $50,000, obviously fake. Like, no one in their right mind could possibly ever think that was nothing, anything but a fake image created as an obvious stupid joke. And as a reply to that tweet, I posted another fake sort of, definitely over the top and obviously fake, but not quite as obvious, I guess, as a fake Venmo payment from LeBron James to Anthony Davis. It was an Instagram comment in like classic LeBron internet speak with his unnecessary hashtags and over the top, you know, emojis and et cetera, just alluding to Anthony Davis, wanting Anthony Davis to come to the Lakers, and that blew up. And, you know, I came back a few hours later to someone like taking a video of ESPN and that image being on ESPN. And I was like, oh no, am I contributing to fake news? I had a little bit of an introspective moment there, but I came away from that being, my takeaway from that was essentially, I think there needed to be a little more checks and balances before that was put on air. So yeah, I think that was probably the stupidest thing that made me laugh a lot in the moment and a lot since.
No, it's definitely funny that happened. Like, it's actually really hilarious that happened. Just like having been on the inside of like having those aggregation conversations, right? Like, mm-hmm. Having to decide like, wait, like let's go to the Instagram page. Like, let's make sure this is real. Like, we have to like check to see if Anthony Davis or if LeBron James like actually sent Anthony Davis a $50,000 Venmo request, right? Like, It's honestly like baffling to me that somehow that got across the line, but you know,
me too, man.
What can you do? Okay, so let's talk about the Suns. I mean, do you have anything else you want to talk about with meme culture on the internet? Because it's you've really become the proprietor of it on NBA Twitter, in my opinion.
Well, I appreciate that, but not too much to add. I will say, in past years, I think I spent a lot more time making memes, making jokes about NBA at large, other teams, because the Suns were never in the playoffs. This year, my attention and most of my time on Twitter has been hyper-focused on the Phoenix Suns for obvious reasons. I've had about, I guess, 10 years worth of jokes to sort of playoff jokes to focus on within Suns Twitter. So I haven't, you know, spent as much time making jokes, saying stupid shit about teams that aren't the Phoenix Suns. But hey, I'm glad to finally have a year after many years of practice on Twitter to actually spend some of this really stupid energy on the Suns.
Well, and you get to have fun this year, and that's the most important thing, because the Suns are good. And I guess my first kind of question about the Suns is, did you expect any of this year? Like, not even just forget the finals, right? Just how good did you actually expect the Suns to be this year? Because I thought that there was, like, I was excited about the Suns because I think Chris Paul is really good and was really underrated coming into this year. But, like, I don't think I expected second in the West and, like, win 50 games in a shortened season and everything like that. Like, so where were your expectations coming into the year?
I honestly don't know anyone that expected that. That's probably some folks Suns Twitter who will say they expected this, but, and I'm sure they did, but me, no, I was definitely not one of them. I think before the season, my hope was that they would get to the four seed to sort of get home court advantage in the playoffs. That was my optimistic sort of expectation. My realistic expectation was somewhere between 5-7, and I was just hoping they got above 7 so they could avoid the play-in. That was where my head was at before the season began, and really through the first sort of month of the season. And then everything sort of started getting better and better from there, February onwards. And then I think everyone was surprised, but as a Suns fan, I was like, oh, wow, I have to really raise my expectations. But at the same time, remind myself what my expectations were from at the beginning of the season to tell myself to not take this season for granted.
Well, at what point did you figure out, okay, this is real? Like, was it around like February where you were just like, oh my god, like this team might actually be able to like win a playoff series or two?
Yeah, there were, it's weird. There were two moments to me. There was one moment which is arguably probably maybe the lowest point of the season. So they fell to 8-8 after losses against the back-to-back losses against the Nuggets. Late January, they sort of bottomed out at 8-8, a 500 record. This was when Devin Booker got hurt in the first Nuggets overtime game, and then they lost the very next night against the Nuggets again, also in overtime. So that was a tough stretch, but they took the Denver Nuggets, who at the time had Jamal Murray, to back-to-back overtime games, and one of them was without Devin Booker. There were some, you know, a bunch of tough things happening in the game, and I came away from those games cautiously optimistic because there were signals there that, you know, Chris Paul was figuring out how to, you know, work the offense. Devin Booker and Chris Paul were starting to gel. There were definitely signals there. And then the other point where it totally set in was I believe they had three game stretch where they beat the Celtics, the Sixers, and the Bucks. And that's when I started to realize, oh man, yeah, this team could actually make some noise, more than what I was hoping for. And it wasn't just that they had beat those teams, it was more the way they were playing again. I think it really took a month and a half for Booker and Chris Paul to sort of figure out how to gel and how to play with each other. It wasn't always pretty, especially in December and January. It was a lot of, you know, your turn, my turn. It didn't look very clean. Defense was good from day one, but the offense was very mediocre. And then it started to click in February and after the All-Star break. I think they were just running on all cylinders, and it was beautiful to watch.
Over the years, just how frustrating has the Devin Booker conversation been for you? Because, like, it took me a while to come around on Devin Booker. Like, I thought Devin Booker the first, like, 3 years, maybe not the first three, maybe, like, the first 2.5 years, I was like, I don't really get it. Like, I think he's a great scorer, but, like, the shooting numbers aren't as good as what you would think. And then, I don't know, like, you just kind of watch him, and he was terrible defensively, and you kind of worried about how that would translate to the next level. And then, like, right around, I think it was probably the middle of year three, I was like, oh, no, this guy's actually, like, a total stud and is a monster. But, like, it took, like, me a while to figure that out, and I think that, like, it's taken other people even longer because they just don't watch the Suns because the Suns were bad for so many years. So just, like, how frustrating has that conversation around Booker been over the course of his career in Phoenix so far?
Yeah, I think you exactly are right. It was year three when it started getting frustrating, because years three and four, and even to a large extent last year, his year five, was when I think a lot of the takes from sort of the people who were still hanging on to, you know, he's not that good, seemed very dated. They seemed very based on observations and conclusions made early in his career that hadn't evolved as much as Devin Booker himself had evolved. And that was what was the most frustrating part to me. Because I agree with you. I think year one, you know, he was a rookie, didn't play a whole lot the first half of the year. When he did play, when the Suns season was basically over, you could tell that, you know, there was something there beyond what he was just drafted to be, what he was drafted out of Kentucky for, which was just, you know, a shooter. There was definitely more to his game than was promised coming into the draft. Year two was when he kind of was handed the keys and was, quote-unquote, an inefficient scorer, a looter and riot, whatever you want to call these things, or whatever. I think I've heard it all. I think, like, you've probably also heard it all. But year two, I would say it was the one year where I think a lot of those conclusions were made, and a lot of them were probably fair to a large extent because, like you said, he was not an efficient scorer. He was putting up numbers. That was the one year where I think, like, good stats, bad team guy was the most applicable. It was also the year where I believe he scored 70 points as a 20-year-old. And, you know, that really added fuel to the fire on both sides, right? Like, his fans will say, oh, man, this guy scored 70. Like, yeah, how could he not be an incredible NBA player? And then there's people on the other side saying he scored 70 in a loss. Good stats, bad team. Again. Right. And it just, everyone sort of dug their heels in a little more. Next year, though, year three, like you were just saying, is when his efficiency improved, his playmaking actually improved.
Yeah.
Maybe not statistically significantly, but if you watched it, like, it was obvious that he took a huge leap on the playmaking front. And that's when
that was the big one for me, was the passing.
Exactly.
Like, you could see him, like, making plays for his teammates. You could see him, like, actually running pick and rolls and, like, seeing the way that defenders were reacting to him and seeing the way he was reacting to, like, help defenders. Like, that was the part where I was like, oh shit, like, I was just wrong. This guy's a stud.
Exactly. And that's also because I was a Devin Booker fan, you know, I'm a Suns fan, so I was rooting for the guy. But I think year two, I was like, oh man, there's definitely more to his game. He's being asked to do a lot as a 20-year-old in an incredibly unstable environment with a terrible supporting cast. And given all the context, I cut him some leeway. But I was like, okay, he needs to be more efficient if he evolves as a player. But again, he's 20. Give him time. Next year was when I also came away from the third year being like, yeah, this guy's a stud. And people who don't think he is are just either not watching, which I honestly don't blame people who didn't watch the 2017-18 Phoenix Suns. I congratulations, you used your time in a much better way. I admire that. But it was frustrating when people would still sort of like dig in their heels and ride with these conclusions despite sort of not acknowledging the context around Booker and how he had sort of evolved. So it's nice to see him get some praise. Finally, I think it's been overdue, but obviously I think being in the playoffs, having success in the playoffs is necessary for any young player to sort of get to that level nationally, even with, you know, casual fans, but especially with the media to a large extent. So I think it's overdue, and I'm glad he's getting the praise that he's getting now.
I guess that, like, my next kind of question here is, it's going to sound like silly because Chris Paul is the guy who finished fifth in the MVP race this year. But, like, the reason I wouldn't have voted Chris Paul top five in the MVP race is, like, I kind of think there's a case that Devin Booker was better than he was this year, to be honest. I think Chris Paul was certainly more important to Phoenix just in terms of organizing the defense and holding DeAndre Ayton accountable and, you know, X, Y, and Z, all of the leadership things that Chris Paul brings to the table that are important. But just in terms of, like, playing basketball on the court, I think that Devin Booker was probably a little bit better than Chris Paul this year, and that it kind of sticks in my brain a little bit. I mean, like, how weird has that conversation been as a Suns fan? Because it does feel like Chris Paul has gotten all of the publicity because he's the new piece that has come in and in many ways transformed what Phoenix was doing. But also, like, Devin's probably been a little bit better than he was, like, throughout the course of the season. So, like, how hard is that for you to kind of, like, navigate in your head when trying to be like, oh, well, like, you know, who do you just have, like, multiple best players on the team that you just, like, full on trust at any moment? Is that kind of what that does?
Yeah, I mean, don't get me wrong, like, I love Chris Paul, and like you were saying, it's so hard to quantify what a guy like Chris Paul does off the court or in practices, what he does to Ayton. Ayton talks about it himself now. It's like, he literally said Chris Paul's the best thing that's happened to his career. And it's really hard to quantify that. But you're right. I mean, again, I agree with you. I think you can make a case for either guy being better on the court this year. I didn't have Chris Paul in my top five in MVP voting precisely for the same reasons. I think he did get maybe a little too much credit. It is a very easy and convenient
narrative
place to, narrative and a place to attribute credit because the Suns were bad before Chris Paul and now they are very good with Chris Paul. There's a bunch of other things going on there. And I think Devin Booker is one of those things. I think the way I look at it is, in a lot of games this season, I think Booker was the reason that they stayed in the games, why they were competitive and maybe even had leads throughout most of the game. And Chris Paul chose his moments very carefully. Chris Paul sort of picked his spots. And you've seen it. Like, Chris Paul sort of waits till the right time to be aggressive.
Yeah.
And sometimes that resulted in some games where, like, Chris Paul, I think, could have been more aggressive, and he wasn't. And whereas Devin Booker was. And I think he was better from a lot of big parts of the game. And it's really hard to sort of figure out who was better overall on aggregate in a binary way every game. But I think that's why they worked so well together, to be honest. And I think Booker is sort of the engine of the Suns, where in terms of dictating the offense and things like that, but sort of like keeping them running, whereas Chris Paul is the closer and the guy that sort of puts them over the top.
Well, and it's part of the reason I was such a big fan of the move, like, when they acquired him last year. It's just that they complement each other really well because they both can shoot off the dribble. They both can shoot off the catch. Chris Paul's an unbelievable defender, incredibly smart team defender. I think Devin has improved over the years defensively, but, like, the level he's shown this year defensively is clearly better than what he's ever shown in the past. And I think in part it is because Chris Paul has shown and provided that level of accountability necessary for the team. So I really liked the idea of these two combining together whenever the Suns acquired them, in part because I thought Chris Paul would foster the development of Devin Booker and would foster the development of DeAndre Ayton and would work really well with Mikal Bridges. But, like, I don't know. I didn't see this shit coming. Like, it's wild that they're sitting here in the goddamn NBA Finals, and we're going to take a quick commercial break, and then I want to run through some fun moments in the recent Suns past here. And we're back. At what point was the lowest point in this, like, recent Suns, like, tenure? over the last, let's say the Robert Sarver post 7 seconds or less era. What was the low point for you?
Oh man, a couple come to mind. One, I think just emotionally, the Steve Nash trade to LA was one of the first low points. This was exactly 9 years ago. This was July 4th, 2012. Steve Nash asked for a trade to LA and was granted a trade to LA at the Lakers. And this was, you know, I was 9 years younger as a Suns fan and maybe not emotionally equipped to deal with my favorite player of all time. The reason why I even started watching basketball and got into the Suns and got in the NBA at large, Steve Nash, being traded to the team I sort of despised the most, the Lakers. And I was like, this signals sort of the absolute end of the era that the Suns were like clinging on to for the last 2 years, from 2010 to 2012, which was sort of the post-Amari years with Steve Nash, where they were a very mediocre team, about 500 for 2 years, didn't make the playoffs, and they finally hit the sort of reset button there. So I think emotionally seeing, I think Steve Nash traded away and the complete end to that entire era that caught me as a basketball fan was one. The real low point, though, in terms of just basketball, was I think the 2017-18 season, the very beginning of that season where, you know, the Suns were coming off a really bad record in 2016-17. But there was a little bit of optimism, you know, Devin Booker's third year. We saw, you know, him sort of, this was coming off a 70-point game season. Yeah, there was some excitement around Booker. Then there was also Earl Watson, who was the coach starting that season. And this was a coach, mind you, that the Suns just hired. He was the interim coach to end the previous season, and they did not interview any other candidates, and they just converted him to full-time. Because apparently some players on an incredibly shitty team said they liked him. And so Brian McDonough said, why not? Let's keep this guy. Anyway, they started that season, and I think that was a season where the first game, literally the first regular season game, they lost by 48 points to the Blazers. And that was the fastest I've ever seen an NBA season, a team's NBA season start and end. They lost by 48 points in game one. They lost a close game in game two, I believe, to the Clippers. To the Lakers. And then in game three, they lost by like 46 to the Clippers. So in the first three games, they went 0-3 by a combined, and two of those losses came by almost 50 points each. Absolutely. And then the I don't want to be here tweet from Eric Bledsoe. That was what really prompted that. And so then he was traded away. The Earl Watson era ended. That beginning of that season was when it was so difficult to continue being a Suns fan. But thank God for Devin Booker.
Yeah, I think that the two moments that stuck out for me is like a person who is not a fan of the Phoenix Suns. I think the moments that I look at are not the ones where they are like in the most despair and the team was bad, right? They're like the funny moments, right? The first one is definitely the Eric Bledsoe, I don't want to be here, right? The GOATs, honestly, the GOATs is really funny. I did not even think of that. Like, that didn't pop in my mind immediately, but that's a really good one, too. I don't even totally remember that story. It was someone put GOATs in Sarver's office, or did Sarver put GOATs in McDonough's office? Which one was it?
Sarver put GOATs in McDonough's office, and they took shit.
what a fucking owner. There was the I don't want to be here tweet from Eric Bledsoe that still gets brought up because it's a fucking hilarious tweet.
And it's incredibly relevant now because it's Suns Bucks in the finals. So it's the, you know, I wonder if Eric Bledsoe is saying, I do want to be here for once. I wish I was there.
And then the second one is, for some reason, it sticks in my mind when Josh Jackson like no-showed at that Fry's grocery store event and like was Instagram storying himself just like out at dinner with one of his boys like the whole time while all these fans are like waiting in line. And then James Jones has to show up and like buy the fans beer. I don't know why that one sticks out in my mind as a real low point, but it definitely is a hilarious low point of the the Phoenix Suns over the last decade for me.
That is, and I think that was shortly before the Josh Jackson era in Phoenix ended. Maybe that's why James Jones was like, ah, man, I'm done with this guy. I'm not buying beer because of him anymore. Trade him to Memphis immediately. No, that one was funny, and it just that's why he's executive of the year now, James Jones, because he's versatile. He goes out and does everything that's needed, including buying beers for fans.
Was there a point in the James Jones era where you were worried? Because I did. I was pretty worried. I've been pretty critical of James Jones at times. I would say the 2019 draft, where he drafted the guy that was like 27th on my board in Cam Johnson at 11, and just seemed to totally mismanage the thing. And meanwhile, like, he 100% nailed the pick. Like, he was definitely right. And then on top of it, there is just like these little moves he's made over the years where I was like, oh yeah, this guy might not be good. And then you hear stories about, oh yeah, their front office, like, it doesn't really do as much scouting or like in-depth evaluation of guys as what you'd expect. Doesn't matter. He's just really good. Like, he very clearly has this understanding of the way that players work together on the court that maybe you can only get from having played at that level and having specifically been a role player and having to fit within a specific, you know, construct of a team for the many, many, many years that he did. For instance, playing with LeBron James and, you know, being an NBA champion in Miami and playing in Cleveland and everything. So, I mean, at what point did you finally understand, hey, James Jones is good at this, maybe I should trust him?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think initially, you're right, and I will preface this by saying I am absolutely not a draft guy by any means. So anything I thought about the Cam Johnson pick at the time was because of the things I had read from people like you and other people who actually do the research, right?
Oh,
and I was totally wrong.
Like, it was great.
Yeah, and so, I mean, everyone was. I mean, I think everyone had him lower, so I get it. But, like, I think when the Cam Johnson pick was made, everyone was saying, you know, that was too high. So maybe there was my takeaway in that moment was, maybe he could have gotten better value by, like, maybe he could have gotten something else instead of drafting someone much higher.
Well,
obviously, I think he was right.
Well, and it was coming off of the heels of trading 6 for
TJ Warren.
The TJ Warren one was even worse, but it was trading 6 and 6 for 11 in Dario Saric, right? And then they did the TJ Warren deal for, I think they got nothing in that deal and traded TJ Warren in 32, right? For just like cap relief? Is that the move?
Yeah, and in the grand scheme of things, so you're right. And I do want to point out these individual trades. So he traded TJ Warren and second round, I think in the 30s, to the Pacers for cap space, basically for cap relief. He traded Josh Jackson away, but he attached DeAnthony Melton to him, to the Grizzlies, which in hindsight it was probably not a good move because DeAnthony Melton is really good, and got Javon Carter in return. And then this trade, right? The 6th pick for the 11th pick, which was Cam Johnson and Dario Saric, which now looks incredible. The 6th pick was Jarrett Culver.
Yep.
TJ Warren trade.
Like, I'll tell you too, like, if I remember correctly, please, for the love of God, aggregators, do not aggregate this. I believe that, like, Robert Sarver, and I don't know if this is public or not, like, it might already be out there. I think that, like, Sarver had Jarrett Culver, like, to, like, his house. Like, his house has, like, a court in it, I guess. And, like, had him do, like, a personal workout, like, in his house. So it was like, oh, hey, we need to... the thought going into the draft was like, oh, yeah, like, they really like Jarrett Culver. They're just going to take him. And then they moved down when they have Culver sitting right there. It was just, like, a weird thing that happened.
I didn't know that. That's pretty funny. And, I do know that Sarver has, players come over to his house. As far as I've heard, players that are on the Suns, but that's funny that he had a prospect workout there. I guess it wasn't a great workout.
I think that's what happened. Like, aggregators, don't do this. Don't play this game, please. they clearly got it right. Like, they clearly made the right move, and James Jones did the right thing. But
they did, and my whole thing with that is, like, absolutely. I think individually you can pick at the individual moves as not great asset management. For example, the TJ Warren for cap space. That was used to sign Ricky Rubio because he knew after a season with basically no point guards, they needed some competency at the point guard position. You could argue that they maybe even overpaid $17 million a year for Rubio. But that's what the TJ Warren trade was freed up to do. It was two things. It was one, they needed the money to sign a point guard, and two, to free up time for Mikal Bridges in his second year. The Josh Jackson trade, trading De'Anthony Melton, I think, was a mistake. But Josh Jackson wasn't working out. James Jones came in with sort of a clear directive, or at least a clear strategy of, I think he himself has said he just wanted to raise the floor of the team. Because he, after several years with McDonough of trying to sort of, you know, hit on draft picks that missed, hit just bottom out. They continued bottoming out, and that needed to end at some point. And I think he knew that, and individually might have not gotten the most value out of every single transaction, but I think his overall strategy worked. It did raise the floor. They were a better team last season, a team that competed even if they were under 500, a team that was clearly playing better, more competent basketball. And I think this season would absolutely not have been possible in the offseason he had. Chris Paul wanted to come there, but none of that would have been possible if they didn't raise the floor. So I think the overall strategy, even if you can nitpick at the individual moves, was absolutely right. And I think even some of the individual moves have aged really well in hindsight.
Well, and like the craziest thing is the move that, you know, stands out above them all, which is taking DeAndre Ayton over Luka Doncic. And by the way, like, I had DeAndre Ayton number one. Like, I was wrong about that too. And if you look at it, there's almost no way that the Phoenix Suns are in the NBA Finals right now. And if they have drafted Luka Doncic at number one, I don't, like, you could say like the Luka and Devin Booker combination would have led to something great. And, you know, they had Mikal Bridges as well. They could have figured out how to do something with the center position. But I don't know. Like, I don't think I'm convinced that if they would have made the right choice, by the way, and taken Luka Doncic, that they're in the same place they are right now. And it almost just goes to show, like, how weird the butterfly effect of, like, transactions can be in the NBA, where, like, James Jones can have missed on moving De'Anthony Melton, can have missed on, you know, moving TJ Warren for cap space to sign Ricky Rubio. But because he kind of left himself outs at the end of the day, and that out ended up being going to get Chris Paul, the Suns can still take an enormous leap whenever they need to, and whenever he thinks the team is ready for them to take a leap. It's why, like, whenever I've started talking about transactions in the NBA, I'm always so hesitant now to say, like, a transaction is a disaster, if only because of these weird things that happen within these butterfly effects, such as, you know, the team taking DeAndre Ayton at number one over Luka Doncic, then indirectly leading to them going out and trading basically nothing for Chris Paul and creating a complete team that now goes to the NBA Finals. It's just like a weird, it's hard. The NBA is hard to build a team with it.
It is. And I think it's very hard. And I think what he has been able to at least do is try to make a team competitive. I think it's so hard. I think the mistake, there's two big things that I think that Ryan McDonough made a lot of individual moves that were mistakes, but I think strategically, and why I think he was wrong for the job, I think he was sort of, I don't think he's had an end in mind when in sort of like the tanking and the Suns version of the process. I don't think he really knew what was the time to sort of pull the plug on that. And the other thing that I think he just never got right was viewing players as players and not as assets.
Yeah.
I think he messed this up quite often, and I think this is why so many players trashed the Suns after they got traded away. He was terrible at sort of player relationships and management. So I think that is one area where James Jones, being James Jones, helps. He was a player. He knows how to deal with players. He knows how to talk to players. Players love him, and I think him and Monty Williams, I think, obviously have done a huge turnaround in terms of this, just the way players sort of view that team. And I think that honestly has gone a long way in addition to just the overall moves that he's made.
Let's talk about the Monty Williams of it all, too. How great has it been just to not only have a coach that can do, you know, a lot of, you know, intelligent things, make a lot of intelligent adjustments on the court, but is also just like a good person. Like, I feel like that's always really nice as a fan to like root for people that are good people. Monty Williams is one of the people that even like talking to people inside the NBA, like never hear a bad word about. Like it's impossible to hear a bad word about Monty Williams. He's just a terrific human being. And I mean, like, I don't know if you remember the Pelicans version of Monty Williams, but like it was not this. I will say that. Like,
no.
He struggled with rotations. I think he didn't really make crazy high level adjustments. You look at what he's done with the Suns, it's almost like a 180. It's that he truly learned from his time in New Orleans, learned, you know, what he needed to improve at and got better at it, and really has become one of the great coaches in the NBA.
Yeah, it's incredible. And to touch on, you know, the off the court side of things, he's, from everything I've read, everything I've heard, he's just seems like an incredible guy. And I think you see it in how players talk about him and how they just react to things he says. And they would all sort of like go to war with that guy. And I think it's hard to build that level of trust in the NBA as a coach, and he's done it fairly quickly in Phoenix. And obviously all the off court tragedies he's had and how he talks about it, he just seems like a very thoughtful, incredible person. And you're right, it is nice to have a guy like that sort of as the coach of a team you root for. It definitely helps on the court. I'm not gonna lie, I was a little concerned when the Suns hired him. I think it was a good hire because he was in demand. You know, he had some successful years as an assistant coach. But one of my worries was that when he was with the Hornets, like you were saying, it wasn't a very flexible offense. I was worried that his offense wouldn't adapt to today's NBA because I'd seen him and those teams and the limited amount of success they had and the sort of rigidness of those teams with Chris Paul. And those sort of concerns went away to a large extent last year because they were just they ran a fun offense even if they weren't that great. And it was very different immediately from the Monty Williams as a head coach that we've seen in the past. And I was very relieved to see that. And I thought he did a really good job with the roster he had last year. And then this year, it's just been another level. And it's been cool to see. And I think it's an important reminder that, you know, players improve. And I think oftentimes we sort of look at coaches as not improving. And some coaches don't. And we've seen that in the playoffs. But I think like Monty's a guy that you watch him coach and you watch the different style of offenses that he's had over his career. And it's like, wow, yeah, this guy has evolved. It's awesome to see.
Well, it's so funny. Like, we can move to talk about the actual final series now. Like, Mike Budenholzer is clearly improved as a coach, but like he's still not really making the right adjustments or like making a ton of different moves. He's just kind of continuing to go to the well, and a lot of the time the well is good enough for the teams that they've played, like the Nets without James Harden and Kyrie Irving, and the Atlanta Hawks, which were a fantastic story and were playing well, but they just weren't quite as talented as this Milwaukee Bucks team is, even without Giannis. I kind of am a little bit worried if I'm a Milwaukee's Bucks fan that, like, in terms of making adjustments and being able to see what's happening on the court, like, on the fly, this has potential to be, like, a pretty real mismatch in terms of, like, in-game, on-the-fly coaching.
Yeah, I think it'll be really interesting to watch. I mean, Budenholzer has gotten a lot of crap. I mean, some of it rightfully so for not making adjustments. But they're in the finals. I mean, you're right, like, maybe he could have done more, but they're in the finals. They made it this far. I'm super curious to see. I think the one thing I noticed in the Clipper series with the Suns is Ty Lue is in many ways the opposite of Mike Budenholzer. He's sort of the adjustments king, and he, I thought, coached another good series against the Suns. But I think, like, Monty Williams also engaged him in that chess match, you know? Like, he also made adjustments after game four, after game three and after game four, that I think allowed the Suns to sort of end that series. And I think he... And I have trust in him to do that. And I'm curious if Budenholzer is willing to sort of play that same level of chess in the finals. I have a question for you. What do you make of the switch... The increased switching without Giannis that they seem to sort of throw at the Hawks towards the end of that series?
It's weird. Like, I don't know that it had as much to do with Giannis not being there as it did with Trae Young not being healthy. You know what I mean? Like, because whenever... Like, if you're going to be able to get Brook Lopez out on an island against Trae Young, like, that's going to end in fucking disaster every time. Like, I haven't really tweeted about this game at all. Like, I was out to brunch and then rewatched the game, earlier this morning, basically. And I thought the Hawks made a mistake playing Trae Young in that game. A lot of what worked for them when Trae was out was just going big and, like, trying to make plays that way and then being switchable and slowing the game down defensively. The other thing is that Trae Young is more affected by foot injuries, lower body injuries, etc., than other great guards, in my opinion, or other star level players in the NBA, because of how important being able to change directions and change pace is for him. We saw the same thing with James Harden in the playoffs with the Nets. Like, Harden's presence out there, because Harden is bigger and stronger and can deal with post defenders, was probably a net positive for Brooklyn, because he wasn't, like, just giving away points defensively. Also, because Brooklyn chose not to attack him over and over and over, chose not to attack him over and over and over again for reasons beyond my comprehension. The problem with Trae is Trae presents such an easy target defensively for other teams to go and attack that if he can't overcome that with offense, he is kind of a negative on the court. Mm-hmm. When he's healthy, he absolutely can overcome it with offense. He is one of the most exciting best players in the NBA offensively, and what we saw from him in the playoffs I think is going to continue into the future with him. That wasn't a joke. That was who he is. But when he's not healthy, I think he is actually a liability out there, and I think that is more why we were able to see Milwaukee switch. I think that they're going to have to switch against the Suns on some level, because a lot of what the Suns run are these, like, Spain pick and roll actions where it makes a lot more sense to try and switch them as opposed to trying to play drop coverage. Guys like Chris Paul and Devin Booker fucking eat drop coverage for breakfast. Like, it's too easy for them because they're such good pull-up shooters and because they just know how to read that backline defense so well. So, I mean, look, if I was the Bucks, I would be planning on switching a lot of actions in this series. The other thing about it, though, is that offensively for the Bucks, I think a big part of what makes me think the Bucks, if Giannis is healthy and if Giannis can play, why I like the Bucks on-court matchup a little bit better than I like the Suns is because I don't think the Suns have a great matchup for Giannis. I would imagine that what the Suns are going to do is they're going to have DeAndre play as, like, the help side second defender, and then they're going to put Jay Crowder on Giannis. You've watched their games earlier this season. Is that what they did?
Yeah, so they threw a little bit of Crowder. In the two games, I'm trying to remember, there was one game where they played Ayton straight up on Giannis a lot more, to some success. I think Giannis still had a couple of big games. I think in the first game he scored 48 points and then missed the game winner. But I think most of that success came not on Ayton. It came on other defenders. The Suns threw a bunch of guys at him, and I think Ayton was, I think, by far the most successful as a straight-up defender. But I agree with you. I think what they will do is, at least at the beginning of the series, we'll start with Jay Crowder straight up on Giannis and Ayton as the help guy. I would not be surprised if they threw a healthy amount of Ayton on Giannis and Crowder elsewhere, or if he's on the bench, then Ayton on Giannis as well, pretty early in the series.
Well, I think that's what they should do. Like, I think they should just put Ayton on Giannis and then have Jay guard Brook, because Brooke isn't going to, like, take dudes into the post, right? Brooke wants to step away and shoot threes. And then occasionally, like, go grab...
Not when Giannis is playing.
Or, yeah. Yeah, certainly when Giannis is there, Giannis is going to be the guy that's on the block. So if I was the Suns, I would put Ayton on him. But I don't know that that's what they will do, right? I just don't know that they'll want to put that kind of strain on DeAndre to potentially get in foul trouble, because Giannis is very good at drawing fouls, and the main significant weakness of the Suns team, if there is one, is depth in the front court. If anyone has been able, like, it's why I kind of thought the Nuggets, I thought the Suns were going to win that series, like, in five or six, but I thought the Nuggets' one shot was to try and get Ayton in foul trouble, right?
Exactly.
And then have Jokic just kind of run against Saric and Frank Kaminsky and whoever the hell else they're going to put out there at center whenever DeAndre is off the court. Against Giannis, if Giannis is able to get DeAndre in foul trouble, I think that Milwaukee can cause some real issues for what Phoenix wants to do. But, like, we're at the point now with DeAndre that it's easier said than done getting that dude in foul trouble. Like, he's just really fucking good defensively now. There's not another way to say it. He just knows how to defend without fouling, and how to use his length and how to use his strength in the paint without giving up too many free throws and without taking himself off the court.
Yeah, it's I think, honestly, an underrated skill. Maybe it's not underrated anymore. Everyone's noticing it now. But with DA, I think he's just really good at playing up straight and not coming down on shooters. And, you know, he averages just about a block a game, which, for if you just look at it on paper, for a guy his size is not great. But the reason, I think, for that is because he doesn't come down. He doesn't try to actively go out there and block the shot. He tries to stop the defender from getting a good look. And I think that helps. That works out in his favor in the playoffs, as we've seen, in terms of staying out of foul trouble. And I think hopefully he's able to do that against Giannis as well. But yeah, I think you make a good point that I think for foul trouble reasons, they probably won't go to DA straight up on Giannis unless it's late in the game.
Yeah, until they have to, basically.
Yeah.
I'm trying to decide, too, like, is there a world where we just see Milwaukee go small at some point? I don't think they will, because if they do, DeAndre has a chance to just, like, dominate the glass, because that's the other thing DeAndre's gotten great at, is dominating the glass. He's always been an awesome rebounder, but the leap he's taken in these playoffs, particularly as one of the elite rebounders in the NBA. I mean, for God's sakes, the guy is averaging like 12 rebounds in the midst of an NBA Finals run. That kind of play is playing small against DeAndre Ayton, as we've seen throughout the playoffs, has led to teams just kind of giving up easy buckets at the rim and giving up a ton of offensive rebounds.
Yeah, I agree. I would be pretty surprised if the Bucks tried going small at any point in the series. I think if the Clippers weren't able to have a ton of success with it against Ayton, I don't think the Bucks will be able to.
Yeah, so, you know, it's funny, like, going into this conversation, like, I have a group text where we talk about, like, gambling odds and stuff. I kind of thought that, because the Bucks, I think, are right now at, like, plus 215 or so, and if you think Giannis is going to play in the first round, or in the first game, like, that's an incredible number to get Milwaukee at, I think. But the more I talk about it with you, the more I'm like, oh, Phoenix actually does, like, create real problems for what Milwaukee wants to do, plus just has, like, genuine scheme breakers in Chris Paul and Devin Booker. Like, the thing that I always try to talk about is that in the playoffs, your scheme is going to get broken. It's just going to happen. Like, defensively, you're going to have to do something different at some point, because NBA players, especially at the highest levels when you're in the NBA Finals, are too fucking good, right? Like, they just will break whatever you want to do.
Yeah.
How do you adjust to that at the end of the day? And, I mean, there haven't been better scheme breakers in this playoffs than Devin Booker and Chris Paul. And that will require Mike Budenholzer to adjust. And that, as Roger Sherman from The Ringer said, Mike Budenholzer always looks like he just bet an amount of money he can't afford to lose on a casino game he doesn't fully understand. And that is the best description I think I've ever seen of someone in my life.
I cannot wait to see side-by-side comparisons of Mike Budenholzer's face with Monty Williams' on the sideline. They're the polar opposites in like with in-game reactions. It'll be a super interesting series. I think that's my big question as well is, even in the Hawks series, and we've seen it every round, well, maybe not the first round, but against the Nets and against the Hawks, the Bucks offense often, when the scheme does break down, their offense just comes down to a lot of isolation, which every team does in the playoffs to some extent. But I think Middleton was absolutely huge for them in this last series, and I'm super, super curious to watch the Middleton versus Mikal Bridges matchup, because I think on paper, you know, that's a perfect sort of guy for Bridges to sort of stay locked into for an entire game. But Middleton's on obviously quite a run right now, and he's an all-star, and it's hard to slow down. So I'm super curious how that goes when the game sort of falls apart for the Bucks and they start going to a lot of sort of Middleton jumpers or Giannis top of key ISOs. I think this has to be a series where hopefully Giannis is healthy and plays the entire series. And if so, I think this has to be a series where Giannis just dominates, because I don't see a ton of other offensive success for them.
Well, I wonder, like, kind of thinking about this now, does Milwaukee try to go super big or something like that? Do they try and play like Giannis, Bobby Portis, and Brooke Lopez at some point, like all together? Just because with Drew and Chris Middleton, I worry that having PJ Tucker out there, he'll probably, I'm guessing PJ will guard Devin Booker. Like that almost has to, maybe they'll have Middleton on Devin Booker. I'm assuming they'll play Drew on Chris Paul as much as they can. But like the thing about PJ Tucker is that it gives someone for Devin Booker to just like kind of relax on defense with and not have to expend any energy whatsoever on defense. You almost might have to go big so that like you almost have to slide Devin to one of their guards and like force him to defend, right?
Yeah. Maybe. So I don't think you're right. I don't think this is a big PJ Tucker series for the reason you just stated. I think they might even go Jrue Holiday. I think Jrue Holiday is honestly the type of defender that I think he brings a lot of the things Patrick Beverley just brought for a Devin Booker defender. And I think in the second series, in the second game this season that they played, Holiday actually did a really good job on Booker. Yeah. And spent a lot of his time on Booker. So I think they might do Holiday on Booker and Middleton on Chris Paul, which would probably be the way I would go about it if I were the Bucks. Which begs the question, like, what is PJ Tucker really doing in this series?
He's gonna have to guard Mikal then and like stop Mikal from running like any secondary ball screen action. But then if Mikhail's just gonna sit in the corner and shoot or sit on the wing and shoot, like you're not getting anything out of PJ Tucker then.
Yeah. And I think if he's being guarded by PJ Tucker, he has to sort of become he has to keep shooting those mid-range pull-ups that he's started to sort of do every now and then. We haven't really had a Mikal Bridges breakout series quite yet. We've had Ayton in a couple series, honestly, but I think depending on who's sort of guarding him full-time, this might need to be one where Bridges has to be a little more aggressive.
Yeah, you might be right about the way that they line up here. It really probably is going to be Drew and Chris dealing with Devin and Chris Paul, and I don't know, man, like that. Again, like that now just seems like expending a lot of defensive energy from guys that you desperately need on offense, right?
Yeah, exactly.
This is the thing, though, that like this is what Phoenix presents for you, because they have so many good two-way players and they have so many different shot creators and they have size that is also switchable. Like these are the problems that Phoenix creates for you and why they're so good.
Yeah, agreed. And I think, there's so many matchups that are intriguing in this. I think Middleton is sort of like a future best case for offensively for Mikal Bridges. But those two guys going at it, Jrue Holiday, Booker going at it, Chris Paul versus the drop that they traditionally play, Giannis, Ayton. I think this will be an incredible finals.
All right, give me one final thing here before I have you give me a prediction. Where are we at on Suns in four, guy? has this guy been milkshake ducked yet? Like, are we still allowed to like be happy and make jokes about him?
Not to my knowledge. I think, yeah, I haven't heard anything. I think we can continue sort of being happy. I mean, it's not my prediction for the series, but I think it's more of an energy. Suns in four is more of an energy and a principle than it is a true prediction.
Well, we have Suns in four guy. We have Brandon Jennings going Bucks in six. Like, it's just an absolute, it's a colossal matchup of memes here.
Exactly. And that's why I think my actual prediction is a mashup of the two, which is Suns in six.
Okay. What makes you say Suns in six?
One, because it's six is always a convenient and lazy sort of prediction to make. I've done it pretty much every series so far. and it's been true two out of three times. But also I think because I do think the Suns are a better team. I think, you know, the betting odds will give you that. I think there's a question about Giannis's health, but I think, assuming even that Giannis plays the whole series, I do think the Suns, the way they're playing right now, and the questions I have about the Bucks' ability to sort of adjust when things aren't working for them on either side of the floor, I think, and the drop that they'll sort of play at least at the beginning of the series against Chris Paul and Devin Booker, I think, in my opinion, I think like the Suns should be favored to win, but I do think the Bucks will get a couple games because of the Bucks, and they have Giannis, who, if he's healthy, is the best player in the series.
Yeah, I think that the most likely outcome here is the Suns win. I'm going to say they win the first two games because the first two games are in the Valley. They go 3-1 up, and I think they might win in five. The more I think about this series, the more I'm like, oh wait, this is actually like a significant problem for the Bucks, especially if Giannis isn't healthy. I think I'm even going to go Suns in five, which I feel bad about because I have a plus 900 Milwaukee title bet that I've talked about quite a bit. I'm gonna have to consider hedging that bet a little bit here coming up. I don't know if I'm even going to get a great number on hedging it, unfortunately. But, man, the matchup, the more I think about it, and the more having talked it through with you, the more I kind of think it's actually a problem for Milwaukee. And what a turnaround this would be. Like, can you remember a crazier turnaround, let's say, in American sport than the Phoenix Suns winning the NBA title if it is to happen here in, like, 2 weeks?
Honestly, no. And, I mean, I there's probably, you know, some team out there, some story out there that...
Oh, we're 100% going to get called out about this. Like, this is... People are going to call us dumb.
We'll get reminded.
It's going to happen. Yeah.
All right. Yeah, that's fine. But until then, I will live in ignorance. I don't think so. And it's crazy. It's not just the whole decade of just misery that the Suns fans have had to deal with and the Suns have, you know, put up and just unleashed into the sports world. Literally 2 years ago, 2019, they ended that year 19-63, worst record in the NBA.
It was the Josh Jackson
2 years ago,
you know, forgetting a grocery store appointment year.
Yeah, and now they're in the NBA Finals. It's just a completely wild turnaround, and it's incredible. I tweet this out after every series win. 19-63 in 2019. NBA Finals now, or Western Conference Finals a couple weeks ago. It's crazy. It's a wild. Sometimes it's still a little hard to believe that they're doing this. But and you know, people will say good fortune, injuries, all this stuff. Yeah, I mean, every team that's won a championship has had good fortune. The Suns have had good fortune. I'm not going to deny that. But the Suns have had terrible fortune in the past in my entire life of being a Suns fan, so I'm also not going to take any of this for granted.
The following players played for the Phoenix Suns in 2019. Emmanuel Terry, I'm going to be honest with you, like I know most NBA players, right? Like, if not all NBA players, I don't know who Emmanuel Terry is. Like, I do not know. Jawan Evans, George King, Eric Moreland, Isaiah Cannon, Quincy Acey, Ray Spalding, and one Jimmer Fredette played.
Oh man,
for the Phoenix Suns in the year of our Lord 2019. To go from that to NBA Finals in 2 years is kind of inconceivable to me. It's really just unbelievable in every regard. And God, shout out the Suns. It's unbelievable.
It is. It is. It's wild. The fun fact about, so that season you were just talking about, you were listing off players. The final game of that season, the season that they finished 19-63, 2 years ago exactly, Jamal Crawford was a Phoenix Sun and scored 51 points in the final game of his career.
Oh, that was that game.
That was also the final game of Dirk Nowitzki's career, where he scored, I believe, 30 and in a win. And that was a wild... So, Jamal Crawford... So, the final game of the Suns season 2 years ago was Jamal Crawford dropping 51 points in a loss. The final game of the Phoenix Suns season now, 2 years later, could be lifting an NBA championship trophy. Just... wild.
I remember I was at Hoop Summit the year that Jamal Crawford dropped 50, and everyone was like laughing about Jamal Crawford dropping 50 because, you know, Hoop Summit's obviously in Portland and Jamal's from the Pacific Northwest. It was just like one of those things where everyone was like, oh my God, like this happened. Like, how did this happen? This is unbelievable. It's a super cool story, but what in the world did we just see, right? And Jamal Crawford going from dropping 50, or the Suns going from Jamal Crawford dropping 51 to where they are now is unbelievable. Even look at the previous game. That was the starting lineup of the Phoenix Suns in their second to last game of the 2019 season. Mikal Bridges, shout out Mikal, right? Dragan Bender, Josh Jackson, Elia Kobo, and Ray Spalding. That was 2 years ago. That was 2 years ago, and this team is now in the NBA Finals. Shout out to the Phoenix Suns. Sreeker, tell the people where they can find you on the internet.
You can find me on my Twitter at Sreeky Shooter, Sreeky Shooter.
Go follow Sreeker. I swear to God, you will not laugh harder during the NBA Finals. So, like, are you someone who has, like, stuff, like, queued up and, like, ready to go?
Not usually. I mean, every once in a while, I'm not a big draft guy. Every once in a while, I'll think of something that I'm like, oh, not now. I'll save it for later. But right. It's most of it is sort of real time in the moment, because that's how I use Twitter. It's always real time in the moment.
Yeah, like it's funny. Like everyone like yells at me because I have all these typos like in my tweets regularly, and I'm like, yeah, like I don't know, man. Like I don't care.
Yeah, I do too.
It's fine, guys. Go follow Sreeker. I swear to God, you will not laugh harder. This has been the Game Theory Podcast. Please remember, rate, review, subscribe, do everything you can to support the show. We'll be back next week. We'll do some draft stuff. We'll do some other stuff. We'll talk about the finals, I guess. Might talk about some teams that are eliminated and some offseason previews. But until next time, we'll talk soon. Bye.